How do you build a community that not only transforms your health, but it also deepens your relationships and gives you a better sense of purpose? Well, today's guest has done just that, creating a movement that's now impacting men all across the globe. Welcome to the Learn It All podcast, the show that helps today's leaders stay ahead of the game because we believe that great leaders aren't born or made, they're always in the making. I'm Damon Lemby, best-selling author and CEO of Learn It, a live learning platform that has helped over 2 million people develop the skills they need to succeed. I'm joined today with my co-host, Darren Bridget, also of Learn It, and we're thrilled to welcome Tim Whitmire as our guest today. Tim is the co-founder of F3, which is a free international men's fitness movement, and founder of CXN Advisory, where he coaches CEOs and leadership teams of growth-focused organizations on alignment, goals, and execution. In today's episode, you're going to learn about how Tim has helped leadership teams align and execute by overcoming conflicting goals and misalignment. He talks a lot about why fitness, fellowship, and faith are the pillars that men need to reconnect and lead more fulfilled lives. Tim's story is packed with insights on how to build strong relationships and communities and how they can transform lives personally and professionally. Let's dive into this great conversation with Tim.
Thank you guys for having me on. I'm already enjoying myself. We're already winning, so we're good.
Yeah, that's right. We're already trying. As long as we hit 91%, we're good, which we'll talk about later.
Yeah.
Just give us a little bit of a sense about, especially when it comes to business strategy and how you've developed some of these ideas. What's your journey to get here?
It's been a little crazy. We're talking earlier before the podcast. I grew up in the Bay Area. Went back to college in Boston, where my mom's family was from. I've stayed here on the East Coast ever since, and had a pretty full career mainly with the Associated Press that lasted kind of the first 15 years of after I was out of college. Transitioned out of that. The journalism industry was there were signs on the wall for the journalism industry even back in 2006, and landed at a middle market boutique investment bank here in Charlotte called Edgeview Partners, where I was involved in marketing and business development. And it was while I was there that one of my colleagues actually invited me out to a workout that took place in a park called Freedom Park here in Charlotte on Saturday mornings from 7 to 8 a.m. That was just a group of guys who got together and they would use the park and the jungle gym and the hill in the park and just all the kind of the equipment there to do a workout, you know, sort of outdoors. No, you're not a gym. You're not having to pay to join a gym. Just go and use what's there. And it was all sort of body weight exercises. We weren't lifting weights or anything like that. And I had been a runner up until that point, but I was a runner who ran marathons and used that as a license to eat whatever he wanted. And I had gradually put on weight throughout my 20s and 30s and couldn't understand why my marathon times kept getting slower. Because it's one of those things, you know, you look yourself in the mirror every day and you don't really notice the change. And then all of a sudden it's taking you 4 hours and 50 minutes to run a marathon. And you're like, God, what's wrong? You know, what should I do? And I'd sort of put the marathoning aside at that point and was trying to figure out what I was going to do next. And my friend Chuck invited me out to this workout and it kicked my butt. I mean, I could not do a single pull up. I could barely do any push ups. We did a thing that day that was sort of a modified decathlon. And I think the ninth event was we ran like 2 or 3 miles, to a gym, that was nearby and I could run and most of the guys out there couldn't run very well. So I was kind of second or third on the run. And that was the thing that, you know, let me kind of look myself in the mirror the next morning when I woke up and was completely sore or whatever. And I started going out. And it was just this group of guys that I never would have met before. And after about 6 weeks, the guy who led and organized the workout turned to me and he said, "Hey, why don't you lead next week? Why don't you, you run the workout and design it?" And I was like, "Okay, I'm going to make these guys run." And so I ran us out of the park and down a greenway to a street appropriately named Hillside, and I made them run hill repeats for an hour. And they hated me and they cursed me all the way. But I literally had sweat equity ownership in the workout after that, right? I was sort of a partial owner of it. And so that kind of went on for basically the better part of 2 years. And eventually the guy who had founded that is a guy named Jeff Guillebeau, who does not get enough credit for this. He passed away earlier this year. But Jeff was kind of a little bit of an ornery guy, and he didn't like it, because what happened was a lot of us started walking around the community and we were losing all this weight and looked great and, you know, had this new pep in our step or whatever. And people would, you know, you'd go to parties and people would be like, are you doing P90X or, you know, what are you doing? And be like, nah, I just work out at Freedom Park on Saturday morning. You know, you should come. It's free. Why not? And when it grew to about 25 guys, that was when Jeff felt like he was kind of losing control of it. And there were people showing up that he didn't know. And one of them was a city council member. He didn't like that because he didn't like politicians. And at that point, he sort of shut it down. And he said, no new people can come out to the workout. And my friend, a guy I had met who had come in about a year after me, a guy named Dave Redding, who's a civil litigator here in Charlotte, he and I had started meeting for lunch in downtown Charlotte to talk about what this was doing in our lives. And Dave and I got together for lunch and we were like, this is crazy. We got to get this in front of more guys. And that was ultimately the impetus. We sent out a bunch of emails in December of 2010 to basically all the guys we knew who hadn't been out to this workout in Freedom Park, and just said, hey, come out for a workout on January 1st on New Year's Day. And this is going to be a spinoff of this other workout that you might have heard about. And Jeff had started out with him and his best friend, his college roommate from Chapel Hill. And it was just the two of them, and it took them, you know, 5 years basically to grow to 25 guys. We had 35 guys show up on New Year's Day 2011. So, and we ran them around the track at a middle school here in Charlotte, and about halfway through the first lap, their pores started opening up and they started sweating and it kind of smelled like a distillery. And we knew we had something, like, you know, the 35 guys was a lot. And then, you know, the next week there were 40. And instead of it being the thing of like, you know, you go to the gym and in January and you can't get a locker because it's so crowded, but by March, you know, everybody's forgotten their resolutions, and we just kept growing. And eventually we realized we were going to need to split the workouts, and because once they get too big, guys can kind of hide in the workout and not be known. And I'll explain why we called it F3 in a second if you want me to. But we knew we were going to have to split it to be able to grow it and get it in front of more guys. And so it made more sense to kind of split off from that original workout and give it its own name and go our separate ways for that. So that was sort of an 8-year journey of growing F3. And we're now, F3 is in, I think, 49 out of 50 states. I think we're still not in Maine, maybe, and 15 foreign countries. And it's free and it's open to all men. So my first call to action, and I've got another call to action later, but is, if you're a guy you want a free workout, look on, you know, f3nation.com and find a workout near you and post, because we love nothing more than what we call friendly new guys. As far as you know, the F in FMG stands for friendly. But
yeah, so Tim, that's awesome. It's an awesome story. So I got a couple questions right off the bat. I want to learn a little bit more about, you know, what F3 stands for and how it's really helped throughout your life. But let's just start off with, what's your F3 nickname?
I usually make people buy me a beer to hear the story behind that.
All right, I'll send it to you. I'll send you one.
It's okay. All right. It's OBT, and we're in a kind of a red part of the country here. It's more purple these days, but I had an Obama sticker on my car when I first went out in the summer of 2008 to the workout, and Those guys thought it was funny that I was going to vote for Obama, so they called me Obama Tim. So that's what OBT stands for. So
that's great. That's hilarious.
I think Obama Tim is a good nickname. I'm going to adapt it myself, even though my name isn't Tim.
Okay. Well, I gladly wear it to this day. So I have no shame in that whatsoever. So I had guys come up to me from that original group that November and be like, yeah, man, I know we kind of, you know, teased you about that or whatever, but you know, I voted for him too. And I'm like, yeah, I know you did. He freaking won.
your buddy Dave also had another reference that I liked, the sad clown bondage. Helping people out of, can you just say what that is? Because it's a Sopranos reference, Damon, so I know you love it.
It is. I think it's maybe in the pilot episode. It's Tony goes to Dr. Melfi for the first time, and he's she asks him what he feels like, and he said, you know, I'm this important guy on the outside, but I'm a sad clown on the inside. So that's where Dave pulled that. Dave is very good with the nicknames and the acronyms and the basically all the terms of art. And there's a lot of insider lingo in F3. There's a whole, it's all very tribal. Everybody gets a nickname. Everybody, and you have to kind of learn the inside language. We call exercises by different names than what they're traditionally known by. So it's very, very much an insider thing, but the sad clown thing, I have to rein guys in, or used to have to rein guys in, because they wanted to be like, you know, yeah, we're going to go out and tell people that they're sad clowns and that's how we're going to get them to the workout. And I'm like, that's not marketing 101, guys. You don't tell somebody he's a sad clown and that's why he needs to post to this workout. The thing we figured out, and we really reverse engineered this from what it did in our lives, was Dave and I both were in, you know, I was not in great shape. He was not in, he tended to yo-yo up and down much more. He would get up to, you know, 40 pounds overweight and then work furiously to get it off. I was more kind of packing it on a pound every month or so, but it got us in really great shape. And then the thing we realized that it also did was it had cured our loneliness problem. And this is talked about a lot now. You've got a lot of people, you know, Scott Galloway's out in the culture talking about this. Richard Reeves is doing a good job talking about it. But in 2011, nobody was talking about the fact that, a severe condition in sort of modern male adulthood in America was loneliness. And so that was we had met this group of guys who, by virtue of sweating together, and you know, you both are, it sounds like, are athletes. Damon, you played baseball, right? You were in the locker room. You get back to my glory days.
Absolutely.
Exactly. And you get, you know, you have that team ethos, you have that locker room mentality.
You have a bond, and everybody, you
do something hard together, and that automatically builds bonds. And so, you know, so the first F is really fitness, and the second F is fellowship. And the fitness is, we call it the magnet, because it's really easy to approach another guy and be like, hey, man, you want to come to a free workout? And sometimes it's a little weird, because like, yeah, it's in the park, and it's with a bunch of other guys, and it's in the dark. But you know, most people, you can get them past that. But it just makes it a very easy ask. And then that second F is fellowship, and we call that the glue, because once you're past the initial thing of like, oh, I'm getting up at 5 a.m. and I'm going to go to the workout, you know, the alarm goes off, and maybe you had a short sleep the night before or whatever, you're not that eager to get out of bed, but the reason you get out of bed is because you want to see your buddies and you want to know what they're joking about on the text thread later in the day, you know, after the workout's over. So that's really that second F. That's the glue that keeps you coming back. And then the third F is faith. And I know a lot of people are allergic to that word, and it's often used as a weapon in our country these days, unfortunately. We just could find no other word that expressed what happened when a man was fit and friended. And that was the ability to sort of turn outward and want to do something in the world other than just ensure your own survival and that of your immediate family. So we just, we saw too many guys. And so for some of them, it was a religious thing. It was, you know, going deeper in their religious faith. But for others, it was, you know, man, I was in rehab myself once. I want to go start an F3 workout at the rehab center, you know, downtown Charlotte, or at a homeless shelter or something like that. And or I want to lead a mission trip somewhere. So and even, you know, even not even necessarily philanthropically minded. I mean, I've got a guy who I'm very good friends with here in Charlotte, and his thing is he loves to travel. He loves to do kind of epic bucket list trips. So Dozer organizes guys to go to, you know, hike rim to rim to rim at the Grand Canyon. You know, I did that with my son a couple of summers ago. A bunch of us went down to Patagonia and did the W Trek last November. So that's his thing, you know, and that's kind of his faith. So it's just that outward turning. So those are the three F's, and it were. It's open to men of all faith and no faith. And I often tell people, you know, if my total addressable market is 50.2% of the world's population, and if I have to lose 7.5% who won't touch it because the word faith is in it, and I lose another 7.5% because we're not praying to their specific God, that leaves me 85% of 50.2% of the world's population. That I'll take that for a TAM.
Yeah, that's good. This is pretty good numbers right there. Yeah. Well, there's, I mean, look, focusing in on a specific group makes sense because you get focused, and you clearly were filling a need. Like this idea of fellowship. In fact, even the nicknames and the whole sort of style of it, you create that kind of that tribal fellowship, yeah, high context culture, because you start to really understand each other and you get into like a good flow, yeah, which is, for me, then this transition into this idea. And I think we should talk about kind of, you know, your work in building your business and how you got there. But you've got this great metaphor with your business when it comes to, again, it's a sports thing, but it's just so interesting, which is, can you talk about the coxswain? Is that how you say it in rowing?
This is why I named my business CXN, so people wouldn't have to try to pronounce the word coxswain, which is hard. So very intentional. So look, I rowed crew for 2 years as an undergraduate in college. I was a novice when I arrived at school, but and I went to Harvard, and in those days, there were not a lot of high school crew programs out there that they could recruit from. So really, to build a strong crew, they had to cast a very wide net, and they had to be willing to take people who had never been in a boat before and teach them to row. And so that was an incredibly formative experience. Damon and I were talking earlier. I never played sports growing up as a kid. My mom was single. She raised me and my brother by herself in Northern California. All she cared about was that we were strong academically. She didn't really understand the importance of sports in boys' lives. Just didn't have that understanding, and so it was not a priority for her. And so when I got to Harvard and I, you know, had a chance to you know, go out and be a part of the crew team, that was hugely formative. And you maybe can see in the background on the wall here, I've got some crew posters, and you put eight guys in a crew shell together, and there are no stars in a crew boat. Everybody has to learn to row together and in sync. And in fact, the boat will not balance if the oarsmen are not sliding forward on their seats and bringing the oar forward to catch it in the water at the same time and at the same pace. And so you get it's very easy for a boat to be out of balance. And the only way to truly balance the boat is to have complete synchronicity among all eight oarsmen. And the coxswain, who I referred to a moment ago, that's the little guy or girl who sits in the bow of the boat and tries to get those eight people to row in synchronicity with each other. And that's the job of the coxswain. And so my professional job these days is I work with leadership teams at growth stage companies and try to get their leadership teams rowing with the kind of alignment and synchronicity that a good crew rows with. And it's tough. I told you earlier there were maybe 15 strokes that I can think of that my crew took freshman year for the entire, and we took tens of thousands of strokes in practice and races. There were maybe 15 where we truly had what you would call swing, which is when all eight guys are really in sync and where the boat moves with the power of 9 or 10 people instead of just 8. So
Tim, when you're working with leadership teams, why do you think it's so difficult to get everybody moving in the same direction?
Because we're people, man. I've got my preferred personality test, you know, my 5-factor personality test that I can put people through or you can do a Myers-Briggs or you can do, you know, a DISC profile or whatever. You get all the typologies or whatever. But like, I mean, we've all got completely unique circumstances. Nobody else grew up the same way I did, saw the same things I did, experienced the same stuff, has the same skill set that I do. And so the notion that people would approach anything the same way is almost unthinkable. And then, you know, throw in other factors like, you know, your typical, you know, I work with a lot of SaaS businesses, right? Like that's been something I've worked with a lot. Leadership teams, you've typically got a CTO type person, you know, somebody who's head of technology. You've got a sales function. You may have a head of operations. You may have customer success. These are all completely different people with completely different loyalties within the organization. And then you've got a CEO sitting up top who's got to try to get them to work together. But it's really hard. You know, the sales guy is going to fight for what he thinks is right for his sales organization, particularly if he's a former salesperson himself. You know, the chief, the head of operations is going to do the same. He's going to, you know, fight for what makes his job the easiest. The CFO is going to take another. So getting all those people with all their different backgrounds in alignment is really hard. And I, you know, I often use an analogy. If you and I start out from the center of downtown Charlotte and we walk due north, and Damon, let's say you're walking due north and I'm 1 degree deviated from that out of 360. Doesn't seem like much, right? But just 1 degree out of 360. By the time we hit the Virginia line, you and I are going to be 5 miles apart from each other. And when you think about the speed at which a growth stage business moves, that becomes that much more magnified, that distance and that gap. So if you don't have a leadership team that agrees on what the core strategic objectives of the business ought to be, you're pulling at each other all the time. And one guy's going in one direction, one guy's going in another direction. And just that difference of like 3 to 5 degrees in misalignment puts things completely off kilter, and it becomes impossible to get anything done.
I totally agree, especially when you have a leadership team. Everybody's typically high performers from where they've come from in the past. They have different ambitions.
Yeah.
They feel like their direction may be the right way to go, you know, and the speed of light, everybody's moving so fast. So where do you start with that then? What's the number one thing you start with to get people aligned?
Well, so I've got a whole analogy, and we could do probably a whole another hour on this. I'd call it tentpole leadership, and it has to do with something that I ended up seeing in F3. And one of the things that, and all the credit goes to Dave for this, because Dave was an Army Ranger. And one thing they do in the Army is they teach you to write really good, really clear mission statements, right? And so the mission of F3 is to plant, grow, and serve small workout groups for men for the invigoration of male community leadership. So there's a task, plant, grow, and serve small workout groups for men. And there's a purpose, to invigorate male community leadership. That's really clear. I defy you to go on the website of any Fortune 500 company and find a mission statement that is that clear. Most mission statements are about puppy dogs and kittens and rainbows, and we're a company of integrity, and we're this and that. So, you know, all things to all people, right? So this was we had a very clear mission statement, and we had a very clear set of five core principles that were rules that by which we ran F3. It's free, it's open to all men, it takes place outdoors at a publicly accessible or at a publicly accessible location in rain or shine. It's led by a member of the workout with no training or certification required. So some guy's not standing there with a clipboard counting your reps. He's actually doing them with you. And then it ends with what we call a circle of trust. And those are the only five rules that define an F3 workout. And and then we got a vision, which was we leave no man behind, and we leave no man where we find him. And those form a center tent pole of F3 that defines what the group is. And then if you think about a circus tent, there are all kinds of different groups with different motivations that can kind of gather under that tent, right? We're open to all men, so we're not going to turn anybody away. So if you think about a typical four blocker, and I plot on the y-axis how intense a guy likes a workout, and if I plot on the x-axis what his social orientation is, whether he's a lone wolf or a pack animal, I can pretty much plot every guy in F3 somewhere within that four blocker. And when I started to do that, what I realized was that the center where the X and Y axes intersect is our tent pole, and the groups can go and they can pull at the corners of the tent as much as they want. And it's the strength of that center tent pole, though, of the clarity about mission, vision, and core principles that allows the tent to stay up and to cover all those other people. So that the very first thing I do with leadership groups is, all right, let's define this company. What are the core, you know, and sometimes it gets complex. Some of them want three or four different axes that they're plotting on, but it's like, let's really boil this down to what is our center tent pole as a company? What audience are we trying to reach? And what both internally and externally. So we sort of go through that exercise and try to achieve clarity about what our core strategic objectives are. And then it ends up being a process of like, okay, can we agree on what these are? And can we agree to lock arms and come out of this room as a leadership team in full agreement and to present that to the rest of the company?
So this is going to make sense in just a second, but I'm going to throw this out here because it's kind of interesting. Do you remember the movie Alien? It came out like 77 or 78.
Oh, Alien? Yeah, no, I'm a big Alien guy. I've watched
the original one, right?
Yeah.
So do you know the way that movie was pitched?
I've read a little
bit. You might have heard this. So the movie was pitched because in 1975, Jaws came out, and it was the first summer blockbuster. And we had nothing but summer blockbusters after that. And so they pitched Alien, Ridley Scott's first movie, as Jaws in space. And as soon as you hear just those few words right there, you know exactly what the movie is. And they greenlit, you know, all the millions of dollars or whatever it took to make that movie. And when you're writing screenplays, the idea is if you don't have a great title and if you can't do the log line like that and have it be so clear what the movie is, you don't have a movie yet.
Yep.
And to get a bunch of people in a room who all think, you know, with the tent pole, think that their company should go in different directions, to get them to agree on what that log line is, that simple explanation of who you are. It sounds great. And as soon as you say it, I think, we got to be able to do that. And I know people are able to do it, but it still seems really hard. Like,
It is very hard.
To actually get there with a mission, because everybody does it, and they redo it every couple of years. Let's redo our mission. Let's do our values, but to make it meaningful.
Well, and the other issue is there's an external facing component to this as well, right? Like, we worked with a group once, Dave, and this was when Dave and I were kind of doing this for a group, and they were all selling technology in some form or another, and their company had these lofty goals, you know, we're this and that, and, you know, puppies and kittens. And for this group, we had to boil it down to sell more stuff, man. Sell more stuff. It requires it. So you sometimes end up in a situation where there has to be an internal mission statement that is not necessarily public facing. Public facing is for public consumption and it makes you look good on the website and everything. But like, there's got to be an internal clarity about what we actually do. And it becomes more of a struggle. You know, I've got a client right now that's really wrestling with this, where they've got a lot of, you know, younger millennials and Gen Zers coming into the business, and they're a consulting firm, they're in professional services. That, you know, you need to make certain margins to keep the lights on, but you also need to really motivate these younger employees who really want to believe they're changing the world. And they may get kicked around a little bit and eventually age into old employees who are a little bit more realistic about this stuff. But there's got to be, you've got to give them something to really hang on to that has purpose to it. So,
yeah, I think we work with a lot of our clients and they kind of say the same thing. The younger generations, they really want to know the why, the why behind it. How is what I'm going to do make an impact moving forward, I think it's interesting. Yeah. And I think part of it goes into, because we've been, like Darren said, we've been through mission statements, vision statements, arguing to see if mission and vision statements are different or the same. But I think a critical part of this as well, and I've heard you speak about it, is can you talk a little bit about the importance of having a unique value proposition?
That's really where the mission gets strengthened, right? Is you can't be selling you can't be selling hamburgers, right? Everybody's selling hamburgers. You can't be a commodity. You can't be doing the same. You've got to have an approach that's differentiated in some way. What's our differentiated approach at F3? You know, we're a fitness group, right? There's a million fitness groups out there. In our case, it's we're men only, and there's no physical box associated to it, right? Like, you know, people talk about CrossFit boxes and this and that, and, you know, or Orange Theory boxes or whatever. There's no box. You can plant F3 wherever you want, and you can make it work wherever you want. All you need is a parking lot, right? Or a park. And that, our unique value proposition is we're free and we're open to all men. I mean, all those core principles, that's basically the unique value proposition of the group. When you're more commoditized or sort of trend based, and this is the other great thing about F3 is those five core principles allow for endless variation on those themes, right? But when you're CrossFit, there's sort of a life cycle to it, and people get burned out on it. Maybe it's trendy for a while, or you're P90X, and that's cool for a while. Maybe you're Orange Theory for a while, but you're sort of subject to fashion and you're locked in. And if you can't adapt with the times, then there's nothing, there's that unique value proposition becomes boring to people, or they're moving on and looking for something else. So.
Then something that we've talked about a little bit so far is, this idea of swing. I love this idea that like 15 strokes out of all those tens of thousands of strokes are the ones where you really feel like you're in sync.
And it would have been more if I had been a better oarsman, I'll put it that way.
But. Okay. But even still, it's a great metaphor, because people can get synced up but to really have that acceleration is kind of an exceptional moment and something kind of aspirational to strive for. Like, there's a certain beauty in striving for that swing. Yeah. But you also, and you're working on a book, this 91% book, which is this idea that if you're chasing perfection and you're, trying to grow, you're in a growth stage or just as an individual, that's going to be a trap. So can you talk a little bit about that? Like, how does swing and going for that still work with this idea of 91%?
Yeah, so this is just, I think you could also characterize it as consistency in some way as well. The 91% I get from my oldest son, Alex. He's a second lieutenant in the Army now. And my wife and I joked, he went to a very, academically competitive high school. He was in the International Baccalaureate program. And one of the things there is that once you're above a 90, that's an A. Right. And there are no A pluses. There are no A minuses. It's just an A. And you have to admire Alex, because if he didn't really care about the subject, if he didn't love it, if it wasn't history or international affairs or something like that, they have a course called Theory of Knowledge that he liked a lot, he would get to that 91 and then he'd be like, no, that's it. I'm not going to work any harder. This is good enough. I got my A. That's good enough. I used to say, you know, if you'd been doing pull-ups, you know, you would get your nose just above the bar on the pull-up and that's good enough. And so I just love that, because if you want to go for it, if you want to really excel, if it's a subject you're really passionate about, great. But 91% is good enough in most cases. And I'm bothered by, and I think this is really accelerated by social media and some of the others, you know, the competitive nature of society now, this notion that everything's got to be a peak experience and we've all got to have perfect lives and it's all got to be perfect all the time. And look, I ran 43 marathons in my life. At one point, I was trying to do all 50 states plus DC, and I had good days and I had bad days, but I ran one in San Francisco, where you guys are from, in 2013, where, you know, where I grew up. It was a meaningful race to me. I did it with one of my best friends, and we trained like, you know, and this was one out of 43 marathons I ran in my life. But Matt and I, our training was perfect. We went out at an ideal pace. We came out at kind of 8 minute, 30 second miles. I said, we're going to go 8:30 for the first half marathon, and we're going to check in and see where we are. And I just knew I had complete confidence in my ability to pace us to that finish. And I said, and if things are going well, we're going to then we can, you know, bump it up from there. And I had to hold him back because he wanted to run more like 8 minute pace or whatever. And we got to the half marathon at 1:53. Completely even splits the whole way, and then brought it in 1:51 actually, and ended up running just under 3:44 marathon that day. And that was literally the best marathon I ever ran, and it was because a lifetime of sort of 91% commitment to, you know, hitting 90, you know, being out there 9 days out of 10 training, right? Giving that kind of 91% effort positioned me to where on the day when it really mattered and I really wanted to do it perfectly, I could. But that wasn't going to be every day. I couldn't have turned around and done it again the next day, right? It can't always be like that. But that notion of being really consistent and giving your best effort, and then if you can get people in alignment, like Matt and I got in alignment on that day, you can have something really special happen.
So you are a natural coxswain, because you kept that pace perfect, didn't you?
Yeah.
It is actually the combination of both things, because it's that consistent metronome. And then if you get it just right, it's almost like through that consistency, you might hit these sweet spots where you just take off.
Yeah.
It's a really cool.
No, moment. And the negative, sometimes the negative of this is true, right? Like my daughter was a national class competitive swimmer in junior high and high school, and she swam. Yeah, she put a lot of time in, and she, at the age of I think 14, she swam I'm gonna misremember the time, like a 101.84 in the 100 breast at a sectionals meet down in Georgia, and that was just like a mind-blowing time for somebody at her age. It qualified her for the U.S. Open meet that's for swimmers 18 and over. It was her first national cut time. And it happened because she swam every single stroke in that race perfectly. It was this, you know, magical combination of technique and training and everything. It was like a golfer shooting 59, like everything just went right. And she spent the next 4 years trying to live up to that one time and not being able to recreate it, right? She grew a little bit more. She, you know, her body wasn't perfectly attuned like it was. She wasn't in that peak form. And it can become this weight that wears you down. You know, she was the girl who swam the 101.84. Why couldn't she do it again? And it become, you have to And she had to learn this. And I think she kind of learned it now. And she did went on to do other great things, qualified for Olympic trials in 2020, and had a great college swim career that just ended. But you have to learn to live with the fact that not every day is going to be a 101.84 or a 3:44 San Francisco marathon. It's just, and you got to be able to savor those peak experiences.
That kind of pulls us into the idea of resilience. Because it's kind of, and actually, Damon, you talk about this too, this idea of, kind of imposter syndrome and almost bouncing back from like too much success or too much expectations. But the transition I was going to make into this thing that happened to you a year and a half ago, where you had a really big obstacle to overcome, and it seems like it's a lot of the work that you'd done prior to this and the community that you built that helped you. Can you talk about that experience?
Oh yeah, gladly. So I went in for I was a mess as a kid. I was actually born 6 weeks premature in 1970, which was a much bigger deal then than it is now. I think now they have NICUs and all this other stuff, and I was in intensive care for some period of time, and so was not a real healthy kid. And I'd had this heart murmur from childhood that we knew about, and I went to see my doctor 2 years ago around this time, and for my annual checkup, and she told me, your heart murmur sounds different. Let's go get an echocardiogram and see what's going on there. And it turned out that I'd snapped one of the cords in my mitral valve, and I was getting backflow from my left ventricle and my left atrium. So the oxygenated blood was flowing backwards. I didn't feel a thing. I had no impact from it whatsoever that I could feel. But my heart was having to work harder to get the oxygenated blood out to the cells, and so that's a long term risk. So they wanted to go in and repair it. And it was a little, I had some questions about it because I was like, I feel fine. I really need to have this surgery. And it turned out when I was under either, on the table or in the recovery room, I had a pretty severe stroke and pretty massive stroke, and ended up waking up 3 days later. I woke up in the recovery, they woke me up in the recovery room when they realized something was wrong, and I'd have vague memories of them rushing me down to the MRI tube, and then the next thing I remember is kind of waking up 3 days later and the nurse telling me that I'd been yelling for my wife for three nights, wondering where she was. But I couldn't move my entire upper body, and that was pretty scary, and spent a month in the hospital and the rehab hospital. And my wife was kind of key to my recovery. My kids were, I've mentioned two of them, but I've got three. And the F3 guys were really critical to that, because those guys, we didn't widely publicize what had happened to me. My wife is pretty private, and she did not want the armada of F3 pickup trucks coming up for the memorial workout in the hospital courtyard kind of thing. We put the word out to a few guys, and these were guys who I'd been working out with for 12 years and formed many close friendships with. And I spent a month in the rehab hospital doing kind of 4 to 5 hours of PT and OT every day. And they set up a schedule. And I did not do a single physical therapy workout without another F3 guy there to do it with me. And it just sort of, making very real the leave no man behind kind of ethos of the group. So and I had an F3 flag up in my hospital room, and nurses would come in and ask what it was, and sort of explain, and then they'd see this parade of guys kind of coming in to see me or coming into the gym to work out with me. And I had a couple of them say, "Man, you have more friends than anybody that we've ever seen." And I'm like, this thing's kind of a friendship machine. And so I tell people, look, I, I had a conversation with my dad about 3 weeks before before I had that surgery, and he was telling me a story. He knew some guys. He used to live in Jacksonville, Florida, and there was a guy who had passed in Jacksonville, Florida, who was involved in F3, and he died of brain cancer. And my dad had been having a conversation with that guy's widow, and she had told him how much the F3 community in Jacksonville, Florida had meant to this guy, and how they'd rallied around her and him. And my dad, who's not a very emotional guy, he's a tax attorney, but he got kind of choked up, and he was like, you know, you did something here that is going to outlive you, and I'm really, really proud of you for that. And I had breakfast with a good friend of mine a couple of days later, and I was like, you know, I got the surgery coming up. I could probably die happy, you know, because I have my father's approval. And you know, I mentioned earlier, my mom raised us by herself. That's because I'm a child of divorce, like so many people who grew up in California in the 70s. And I said, if I die during the surgery, I'll do it with my father's approval. So that's okay. The stroke was not one of these cases where like it opened my eyes and all of a sudden I realized how, you know, it's not like Scrooge waking up on Christmas morning or something like that, a changed man, but, you just don't realize, when you build relationships and you invest in relationships, you don't realize that you're building the ark that's going to carry you to safety when the flood comes.
We were talking about that backstage. I mean, it's amazing. Like you said, I mean, first of all, it's an incredible story, but like you said, you never really realize what's going on. And then to be able to have that kind of community and those relationships. And I heard you talk about a little bit more about how critical it is to be relational versus transactional, both personally and professionally, right?
Yeah. So look, we'll get to this, my call to action, you know, if anything I've said has resonated with any of the listeners, and I know you got a lot of people who are, you're the name of the podcast says it all. They're lifelong learners, and they're people who are interested in kind of being their best selves. Look, if anything I've said has resonated, go to my website, go to cxnadvisory.com/call and book a call. It's an hour. It's an hour of my time. I don't charge you for it. It may not result in any kind of relationship. I get a lot out of those calls because I guarantee you will say something when we're on that call that I will then be able to use with my other clients. So it's time well spent for me, and it's time in investing in a potential relationship. And I just one of the things I see on leadership teams, unfortunately, a lot of the time is that people are not as relational as they need to be. It's transactional. It's like, oh, if I give you this, will you give me something back? And I'm going to negotiate for this, and I'm going to maximize that. And it's all about kind of transactions. And look, I mean, we live in a capitalist society that's built on trust and transactions and contracts and stuff like that. But ultimately the part that makes life worth living is really, built is really the bedrock of those relationships. And that's, you know, I knew it before I went in for that surgery, but man, did I understand it afterward. So
yeah, definitely. No, I think we'll put that in the show notes, of course. And for our listeners out there, just getting the opportunity to speak to somebody like Tim, you know, you could learn something from every conversation. So whether or not it turns into a long-term relationship, great, but there's just be curious and get the chance to do that. I couldn't recommend it enough. So Tim, you know, you've been pretty vulnerable and shared a lot with us. What is one thing, you know, this is our signature question. What is one thing that you could share with our audience that most people are unfamiliar with about you?
So, I mean, this goes back to
we know you're an Obama fan. We know you had that stroke.
I know.
And you're a marathon guy.
Yeah, a marathon. Well, so here, look, here's the other thing. So I told you some stories about my mom, and my mom was struggling, and she couldn't figure out what to do with my brother and me. We were in after school daycare, and full time in the summer, but we sort of aged out of that after I got out of sixth grade, and maybe James got out of fourth grade, and then we were home alone in the summers. And so my mom worked for the county of Sonoma in a job where she was dealing with a lot of farmers and trying to set agricultural policy for the county. And so after the summer after I was in sixth grade, she basically hired us out as farm workers to a guy who ran an organic flower farm in Bennett Valley outside of Santa
Love
Rosa.
It. Wow.
And it was this group of they were basically, by this time it was the early 80s, but they'd all been hippies back in the 60s and 70s, and they bought this farm as a commune. And so it was all these, you know, sort of the remnants of the commune, and it was an organic flower farm. And my boss, Alan, was a hardcore deadhead. I mean, he'd been, you know, he'd followed Jerry around for a lot of years. Went to my first concert with Alan, saw the Dead at the Greek Theater in Berkeley in 1986. And he used to give us a hard time because those first couple years when we were working on the farm, he said, I should have been paid for babysitting you guys because you guys were worse than useless. But it eventually the tide turned and we kind of figured it out. And he used to, you know, he was kind of an old lefty. So he would, you know, at the end of the summer, he would take us out to lunch and we would have our union negotiations to set the wage for the next summer. And so he became, I mean, my mom ultimately kind of did the right thing because he became sort of that substitute father figure in my life. But no, that was, and I got a great college essay out of it as well. It's, you know, they weren't letting many kids into Harvard who had worked as farm workers during the summer. So
that's a brilliant story. Very unexpected. We have a few things in common that are surprising. Single moms in California.
All right, Darren, book a call, man. Let's talk it out, man. I want to hear the story.
Book a call, Darren.
Book a call. I'll do it. Okay, so let me put a little wrapper on some of the discussion that we had today. I think really it feels to me, if I get a little poetic about it, that what we're heading towards is really everything is kind of just an excuse for community. Whether you're getting together with people in a fitness situation or whether you're building a business, the key is that you're building a community with people, and it's those relationships that's almost the most important thing. And you do it by actually applying some discipline and some consistency and having a very clear direction, the mission that you're going. And when you bring that to that story, you also get these moments of swing, these moments of poetry and kind of a little magic and beauty mixed in. That's what I think I'm taking away.
And I've heard it described. I took a lot of English courses in college. I love reading that. And there's some author somewhere who talks about epiphanies, right? You get these moments of epiphany, and they're all the, you know, to go back to my theme earlier, they're all the more special because they're rare, and you don't get them very often, and you can't achieve them every day, and that's what makes it worth living. I was in the Rijksmuseum a couple of years ago. We took a trip to Europe in Amsterdam, and they were having an exhibit of Vermeer paintings. And I could not get a good look at the Vermeer paintings because so many people were crowded around them taking cell phone photos of these paintings. And I'm like, and I'm not even a guy who necessarily gets that moved by art in museums, but I'm like, you people are insane. No cell phone photo that you ever take is going to be as good as a nice reproduction that you could get on the internet or anywhere else. Why are you know, what's the obsession with this? Who are you showing this to? What are you proving to anyone? But there's it just fits in with this sort of 100%, 110% mentality in the society of like, I've got to capture everything. I've got to do everything. I've got to, you know, have every selfie and everything on the bucket list. And it drives me bananas a little bit. So, but I'm the moments that that matter the most are special because they are true mountaintop experiences. But you can't stay on the mountaintop forever. You got to climb back down. You know,
you can't have an epiphany in front of the girl with the pearl earring if you're doing it through a cell phone.
Yes.
Yeah.
And jostling 50 other people who are trying to do exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
And trying to figure out how quickly you can get it up on Instagram.
Right. Right. Exactly. Right.
Yeah. Along with your meal that you just ate in Amsterdam.
So, Tim, before we close out here, are there any final words or anything that we didn't cover that you wanted to share with our listeners?
No, man. I mean, I just like the two calls to action are, if you're a dude or identify as a dude, I don't really care. Check out f3nation.com. Get yourself out to a workout. We love FNGs, and that's friendly new guys, as far as you know. And then, look, if I can be of assistance, if you're intrigued by anything I said today, if you want to argue that we need to all be going 100% of the time, 100% all the time, book a call and cxmadvisory.com/call, and we can argue it out. So.
Well, Tim, thanks for being here. Audience, please book a call with Tim. Argue it out. Learn something from him. And if you enjoyed today's episode, please like it, share it, tell a friend. And until next time, everybody, stay curious and keep learning. Have a good day.
Thanks,
Goodbye.
Guys. Bye.
Thanks, guys.